Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us. Hawaii Talks on The Conversation on this Aloha Friday, January 23rd. The national headlines about immigration and civil rights are troubling the American Civil Liberties Union. We hear more from the president of the national organization, who was in town recently. What states can do to defend our democracy and how to avoid information overload. We now know more about tiger shark behavior in Maui Nui. New research has unlocked clues to a mating mystery. A new year and a new venture for a James Beard-nominated chef. We catch up with Jason Pio, who breaks down the realities of running a restaurant. And a new children's book about the native species that thrive alongside the ohia tree is out. We hear from the author and illustrator. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio, Hawaii Talks. I'm Catherine Cruz. For more than 100 years, the mission of the American Civil Liberties Union has remained the same: protect and uphold the civil liberties enshrined in the U.S. Constitution. Its membership has grown from a small room at its founding to more than 4 million supporters across the country. And over the course of its history, this mission has led the ACLU to sue for women's and immigrants' rights, as well as represent the National Rifle Association and the Ku Klux Klan. Deborah Archer has been the president of ACLU National since 2021. She is the first African-American to hold the position. Archer was in town last week to teach a one-week intensive course at the University of Hawaii's William S. Richardson School of Law. She spoke with HPR government reporter Ashley Mizuo about how the work of the ACLU has changed during the second Trump administration.
It's interesting. It's pivoted a little bit, but a lot of the work, the level of intensity that we saw from the ACLU during the first Trump administration continued, unfortunately, at a really fast pace, really intensive work. One, because after the Trump administration and the harm that was done to our legal system, to our communities, the threat to individuals that we care about, we had to spend some time to resolve and address those things. But also after the Trump administration, we saw the states turning to pick up that work and saw lots of challenges to civil rights and civil liberties in states around the country. And finally, over the course of our time, the ACLU has sued every single president in our 105-year history. And that included the Biden administration, because the Biden administration also presented some challenges to civil rights and civil liberties that we felt it was important to address. So the ACLU has been, going for years, for quite some years now. But you are right in assuming that the intensity level is even higher today after the first year of the second Trump administration, because this second Trump administration has presented threats to civil rights and civil liberties that are really unprecedented, that we have not seen in our lifetimes. And so it has been quite a year for us.
You brought up the place that states and local government have in pushing back against some of the Democratic backsliding. You know, that's something that ACLU Hawaii talked about during their legislative package unveiling as one of the ways to push back against that. You know, can you talk a little bit more about the role that, you know, state and local government laws can play in this current environment? A lot of the issues are at the federal level. You know, when states and local municipalities are trying to create laws and push back, what kind of role can they have in that?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, because a lot of folks focus, and I think rightly, on the litigation that the ACLU and other civil rights and civil liberties organizations are doing at the federal level. It's important to be pushing back to defend our rights against rollbacks as much as we can. But we also have an initiative that's called the Firewall for Freedom, and that's trying to help states and localities understand the power that they have to both protect their citizens against the threats that we see at the federal level, and also to advance civil rights and civil liberties using tools that are uniquely theirs. So we think it's important that everyone understand that although the harm is coming from the federal government in much of these cases, it's important to know that all the solutions, all the power does not rest at the federal level. So some of it is legislation, getting states and even localities to pass legislation that's responsive to the threats that we see at the federal level. We have seen states step in as plaintiffs and suing the federal government to protect their citizens and to defend the rights of that state. And all of those things are incredibly important.
Yeah, I'm thinking of, you know, here they're talking about doing laws like no secret police laws where, you know, requiring federal officers as well as local police to not cover their face or have identification. And I know one of the things that are brought up when we're talking about those types is, you know, how are we supposed to impose that on federal agents? So when we're thinking about those types of laws, even if they're challenged in court once they're passed, you know, like what kind of place do those types of pieces of legislation kind of have?
I think it's important, right? We often think that there's one lever that we need to pull and we're going to solve the problem across the board. But really, it is that there are going to be 10, 20 different ways for us to come at the challenges that we're seeing to get a whole scale fix. And the solutions that we propose have to look beyond the current crisis. The current crisis reveals some of the holes in our system, some of the weaknesses in our protections, and then we have to think about legislative fixes that respond to the immediate crisis, but then also fix the holes. And laws that require more transparency for police, that require that we know who they are, that they follow the rules, that they don't disappear people, that they respect people's rights, that it is not about building an army of secret police. That is going to respond to the current crisis that we are in, but it also is going to help us avoid repeating this crisis under different administrations and at different times. Of course, there will be people that challenge that legislation through litigation, but that's a natural course of things, and we can defend those acts, we can defend that legislation, and we can win in court. You know, it brings me to a different point that's not directly responsive to your question, but there is this narrative out there that if something is going to be challenged, we shouldn't do it. We should be afraid. And we shouldn't be afraid of going to court to defend what we're doing to protect our civil rights and civil liberties. That's one way that we're going to be able to deepen protections. And we're doing it now. The ACLU has filed about almost 250 legal actions against this administration. And we are winning in over 60% of the cases. And if you look just at the lower courts, the district court and the court of appeals, we're winning in close to 80% of the cases. We can't be afraid of the litigation and the fight that is ahead of us to defend our rights. We have to lean into that and to tell the story that if we fight, we win.
At this time, too, when our state government, as well as, you know, businesses, local institutions, like even our universities are being threatened with rescinded federal funding by not complying with, you know, federal executive orders or, you know, different directives, how can these institutions stay true to their values in the face of the federal pushback and the threat of, you know, losing that federal funding that is so important to them?
All of the things that you've described are the ways in which this administration is trying to weaken power centers, weaken the folks, the communities, the organizations that can push back on their unconstitutional actions. And we need to recognize and connect those dots for what they are, right? The attacks on the media, the attacks on colleges and universities, the attacks on our judiciary, on our communities, on law firms. All of that is a part of a plan to weaken the institutions that can hold them accountable. And so we need to all rise into that power that we have to hold this administration accountable. We need to recognize that executive orders are not law. Only the courts can set what the law is, or Congress. Executive orders do not rewrite constitutional law, constitutional provisions. And so in the face of what we know to be illegal, unconstitutional executive orders, people need to fight back. And we have seen that when these institutions, when universities push back, when the law firms who have been targeted sue, they're winning. The court is responding. When we, as an organization, filed a challenge to the administration's denial of funding to people based on the use of terms that they thought were related to diversity, equity, and inclusion, the court responded and protected and reinstituted that funding. We have to push back. Everyone has to use the power that we have. We assume that we have no power to resist, and the opposite is true. We have incredible power as institutions, as organizations, and as individuals in our communities. Look at the impact of protest. When people recognize that their voices matter, they're willing to use those voices to push back, and we have seen shifts and change, and so we have to continue to do that.
We've been hearing from Deborah Archer, the national president of the American Civil Liberties Union, and we'll have more of our conversation with HBR's Ashley Mizuo after a break.
I'm Bert Lum. Today on Bite Marks Cafe, we catch up with Guy Kawasaki and learn about his new book about Signal. We'll hear why this messaging app is critical in keeping your communications private. That's this evening at 6:30 on Bite Marks Cafe.
Support for HPR comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits committed to helping families of agricultural workers and retirees with affordable housing, such as the Kunia Village Development Corporation, NereidHawaii.com.
Let's get back to our interview with Deborah Archer. Archer is the president of the National ACLU. Its Hawaii chapter was founded in 1965. HPR's Ashley Mizuo spoke with Archer last week.
I wanted to talk a little bit about your book, Dividing Lines, and that dives into, how transportation and urban planning has been used to keep Black communities segregated and perpetuate racial inequity. You looked across the country, and I'm curious if there was any of that that you saw here as well.
Yeah, thank you for bringing up the book. So as you mentioned, the book is about the way that transportation infrastructure really became a tool of segregation post-Jim Crow. To lock in inequality, to block communities of color from accessing economic opportunity, to remove those communities, destroy those communities, divide those communities. The book focuses on the impact on Black communities, but it is a story that repeats in different ways for communities of color all across the country. And the story that we hear most often is about the way that highways have done that work. But the book talks about the way we've also used roads and street planning, public transportation, and even pedestrian infrastructure. I think the story in Hawaii, as you said, is a little different, but really is a part of the central narrative that there are certain communities that are deemed as less valuable, and they get less of all the infrastructure and resources that they need to survive, to thrive, to live happy, healthy, and choice-filled lives. And I've seen that in different ways around essential infrastructure in Hawaii, not having access to public transportation, not having access to water resources, to sewer systems, or the ability to access regular water. So, not having schools, right? Think broadly about what infrastructure is and how we have used it to undermine the growth of certain communities and to support other ones to blossom.
Yeah, I think right now here, we're in this moment where we're building a lot of housing because the housing affordability crisis is really important here right now and critical. And also with that comes the infrastructure building. So right now, this Hawaii itself is changing very rapidly, I think. You know, if you're a community organizer, if you're a person who lives in the community, what should you be looking at or paying attention to ensure that there's, equal access for people when we're building?
And that's exactly the right question, right? I want there to be public housing. I want there to be affordable housing. We need more of these things. We need more transportation infrastructure. But what I think people need to do is to ask the questions, to recognize that these needs are always fulfilled on the backs of particular people. And so we need to be asked, we know what we're sacrificing and who we're sacrificing. The way that people can get engaged first is just to ask questions, to show up. When these decisions are being made by government officials, they're required to hold hearings and give notice that these things are happening. And showing up from the very beginning, each and every time, to ask them the questions, to push them to think about equity and equality more broadly, to force them to reckon with the choices that we've made in the past. Right, to look at the history and how we've not had equitable distribution of the harms and negatives of all the things that we need. So really, at the end of the day, I think the most important thing is to show up. I think it's also important for us to give communities the tools that they need to advocate effectively for themselves and on equal terms. I have found across the country that if we give communities the technical resources that they need, hold hearings at times where they can participate, they engage. They know what is good for their community. They know what the challenges are. It is not that they lack knowledge about the problems and the potential solutions. They lack the resources to engage on the very restrictive terms that we've set. So I think any way that anyone can support a community to join the discussion and advocate for what they need and what they want, I think is going to be transformative.
You know, I think that leads into another thing that I was wanting to ask about, which is, you know, in this moment where it seems like there's so much news happening at once, there's so many different things happening at the federal level, and then that trickling down to the states and municipalities. I think people will read the news or, you know, scrolling on their phone. It's a lot to have all of these things coming at you at once. You know, what has the ACLU been doing to keep people engaged and interested in engaging with these types of current events while there's so much happening at once?
And it is true, right? It feels like it's everything everywhere all at once, that it can be overwhelming. But it's so important that we all stay engaged, that we not allow any of this behavior, any of these actions to feel normal. We cannot let it be normalized. We have to continue to keep ourselves informed and keep ourselves educated and find ways to engage. And so the ACLU is trying to do that, to one, make sure that people are educated about what's going on social media, on our website, talking about the actions that are happening at the federal level. We have these explainer videos where we're trying to break it down, because sometimes if you talk about technical terms, people don't understand the everyday impact, how it's going to impact their lives and their communities. It's going to impact their jobs and their work. So we have these videos that try to explain to folks and break it down in terms that are accessible to everyone. We have blogs that we're trying to also discuss and explain, but we're also trying to help people get organized. So we have an initiative called People Power. People can sign up. We'll let people know, based on their zip code, actions that are happening in their community, ways that they can engage when it's time for them to reach out to their legislator to express their concerns, ways that they can show up for themselves and for other people. So we're trying to make it easy to understand what's going on, and then to help people understand the options on how they can respond and get involved.
Advocacy work is a huge portion of the ACLU's work, but another portion of that, of course, is litigation. And the ACLU has, you know, represented groups and organizations that maybe aren't something that you would necessarily associate with the ACLU ones. Like, I'm thinking about like the NRA as an example. You know, why is it important to still litigate with groups that you wouldn't necessarily associate with the ACLU when you're thinking about the ACLU's values and what they stand for?
One of our mottos is that we're fighting for an America where we the people means everyone, and everyone means everyone. And so we do feel it's important that we ensure that the Constitution, our laws, applies equally to everyone, because they're everyone's rights, whether or not you agree with me, whether or not we are enemies on an issue, whether or not we would fight to the end on the substance of the issue. We believe it's important that everyone's rights are protected. And if we allow the government to chip away and undermine the rights of people because we don't agree with them, we should know that that's going to turn around and be a tool that they're going to use to chip away and undermine our rights. You mentioned the NRA case, and of course that was a case where we represented the NRA at the Supreme Court on an important First Amendment issue, an issue that we knew that in the hands of a different government might be turned against the ACLU, might be turned against people that those government folks, officials disagreed with. And it's true, that NRA decision has been the backbone of our First Amendment litigation, challenging the ways that the Trump administration is trying to weaponize and deny First Amendment rights to people that they disagree with. And so it's important to make sure that we are defending the principles and the laws at stake, regardless of who is trying to enforce those rights at the time.
That was ACLU National President Deborah Archer and HPR's Ashley Mizzouo. The Hawaii chapter of the ACLU maintains a list of about a staff of about a dozen, and recently its attorneys have represented a transgender student on Maui and a Hawaii Island resident detained by ICE and currently held at the Honolulu Federal Detention Center. You know, we often hear Maui no ka'oi, Maui's the best. And you might say tiger sharks agree with that saying. New research has shed light into a tiger shark mating mystery in Maui. And here to talk about that is HPR's Maui Nui reporter, Catherine Kluwit-Pachtel. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
Yeah, sharks are just so fascinating, and I know they like Maui.
They do. So tiger sharks are typically loners, and they have a pretty wide-ranging habitat, according to the researchers who have been following them and tracking them. And up until now, their reproductive habits were kind of a mystery. But now we know a lot more about how it happens. So Paige Wernley is a University of Hawaii PhD student with the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. And she, along with some other researchers, just released this study about shark mating. And it turns out that Oluwalu Maui is a hot spot for the activity and actually the first of its kind to ever be confirmed. So here's Paige Wernley talking about the significance of this discovery.
This really fundamentally changes how we understand tiger shark behavior and ecology. This is the first evidence of a recurring tiger shark mating aggregation anywhere in the world. So we've kind of been able to nail down, like, they don't mate randomly. It's not just random chance encounters. They actually do come together predictably in space and time.
You know, and I know when we've talked to other researchers, they say that, you know, Maui just has this environment. They have a shelf that really just attracts, the sharks to that area.
Yeah, so this research actually came out of about 6 years of data. And the original purpose of gathering that data was to shed light on why Maui has the most tiger shark attacks of any of the main Hawaiian islands. And not surprisingly, it's because the most tiger sharks are living there. And so Wernley has built, and her fellow researchers have built their research and data around that original acoustic tagging that was done for that project. And, you know, we'll talk a little bit about it in a minute, but there's several reasons why Oluwalu in specific might be, you know, this sort of hub of mating activity and the first to be ever confirmed. So, of course, I wondered for residents and visitors that are in the water in this area, you know, is there any extra danger of being in the ocean during mating season, which is January and February? Wernley says no.
If you're in Maui during January and February, it's really cool to be in tiger shark mating habitat during tiger shark mating season. So I love the thought of that. And, yeah, it's also really cool that that area probably has the densest population of tiger sharks during that time of year, because you have not only the Maui sharks, but the additional sharks coming in. We don't see any uptick in the number of bites during that time of year. So this behavior is not linked to any type of aggression, and they're not there because people are there, you know, they're there doing their thing.
Yeah, they just want to do their thing.
And, you know, the data backs that up. The Department of Land and Natural Resources does keep records of shark bite incidents across the islands, and there's only three listed in Oluwalu since the year 2000. So that's not very many at all. There are about 60 listed since 2000 in other areas of Maui. And just for comparison, Oahu is about half of that. So this research was done, I thought it was interesting. They're using acoustic tags, which basically send out signals to receivers that are placed around the islands. And so the acoustic tags last on the sharks for about 10 years, which is much longer than satellite trackers. I was like, why don't they just use GPS trackers? But it allows them to gather a much longer period of data than, you know, GPS trackers would. And of course, we might wonder, how do they attach these trackers? Here's what Wernley says.
We're very smooth and efficient and very respectful to the animals, and we get them in, we get the job done, we get them out. That process involves, we hook up to them using baited gear, we tie them to the side of the boat by attaching a rope to their tail, tying it off to the stern, and tying the line that's attached to their mouth to the bow, and we take some measurements of them, put the tag on, and then untie them and remove the hook and let them go, and they swim away strong. So it's a pretty quick process, down to usually less than 15 minutes in total.
And it is impressive what those researchers do. I was fortunate enough to be on one of those expeditions out there to tag one of those sharks, and it's just amazing.
Yeah, I can't imagine witnessing it firsthand. That's a really cool experience. But why Oluwalu? You know, we talked about how Oluwalu is this mating hub. Well, it's not crystal clear to researchers, but they only talked about a connection to humpback whales, which, of course, we know breed during the same season. Have their calves during the same season, and there are a lot in the Oluwalu area. So adult healthy humpback whales are not considered tiger prey whatsoever. There's no connection there. But, you know, calves that are maybe sick or injured are more vulnerable. And also whale placentas are, known to be food for tiger sharks. So there could be a connection there with the humpback whales in the area. I thought it was really interesting because, you know, I don't know a lot about tiger sharks. But mating is like a life or death experience for female tiger sharks. And they showed, in their research that, and that was one of the reasons how they concluded that Oluwalu is a mating hub, is that the sharks, the adult male and female sharks that they, tagged in that area were covered in like scratch marks and bites. And that's really commonplace for tiger shark mating. And apparently, females are known to only mate once during this season because it's so dangerous for them. Like, it's actually can be life-threatening. So this mating event is not like a huge mass of sharks, as some people might picture. Here's how Wernley explains it.
This study really kind of challenges how we humans conventionally think about aggregations, or specifically shark aggregations. I feel like when the public pictures a shark aggregation, they picture, you know, like a pile of 40 sharks all together. But tiger sharks, they really don't have that kind of behavior. They're a very solitary species. So this challenges our perception of aggregation, where tiger shark aggregation spans over kilometers and weeks. And what it does is really enhances the probability of them encountering each other, because they're typically so wide-ranging.
You know, you did some stories on the reef area there about how it's like a mother reef, right, there on Maui. Did any connection with this, you know, collection of sharks?
You know, it's a really interesting question that I wondered as well. I didn't check with the researchers on both of those studies to see, but, you know, I think the mother reef study that I did before just shows that it's a really healthy reef in Oluwalu, and I'm sure the large presence of sharks, you know, might kind of corroborate that. Just, you know, a lot of healthy things happening there.
Yeah, fascinating. All right. Well, thank you so much, Catherine.
Thanks.
That was HPR's Maui Nui reporter, Catherine Kluwet-Pachtel. To learn more about the study, check out our website later today.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, offering a Master of Accounting program. Learn more at scheidler.hawaii.edu.
This week on This American Life, Alan cut down two trees in his front yard, and when he did, he made some enemies.
There was this crow sitting in the front lawn, and as soon as the crow was out of my sight, that's when I got this thump on the back of my head.
Crows are vengeful. They hold grudges. Alan tried to make amends. But is that possible with an angry bird? This week.
Beginning Saturday at noon.
Support for HPR comes from Costco Air Conditioning and Refrigeration, featuring Daikin Air Conditioning Systems. Listing of contractors installing Daikin products, that's Daikin, at CostcoHawaii.com.
You know, fans of the James Beard-nominated Namikaze are still mourning the sudden closure of the popular eatery after a three-year run.
Chef Jason Peel recently teamed up with Chef Kelvin Rowe at Diamond Head Marketing Grill for a new venture. HPR contributor Sarah Bouchard spoke with Peel about the hardships of running a restaurant and what led to the closure.
I think for Namikaze, it was a big decision that we had to make. We were ending our lease at the time, and we had just expanded. And I think for the business of Namikaze, the expansion really hurt us. We weren't ready to expand. We didn't have a good plan for expanding. And you know, I mean, you can have all good people, as many good people as you need, but if they aren't the right people for what you're trying to do, and if they're not committed to what you're trying to do, then it really won't work. So there's a lot of things that I looked at and thought about and contemplated, because there are so many good people involved. But the bottom line is, if I'm not good, it's not going to be good in the long run. So we pushed really hard, and I had to make that tough choice at one point.
What, in hindsight, what would you have done differently?
I've worked in a lot of tough restaurants and a lot of fun restaurants, and I've seen a lot in different areas of the industry, and I had a vision of what I thought would be good for the next generation coming up and I could teach and grow people to take over. I've been a chef for a long time, and I was looking for somebody to take over. You know, maybe some of that old school was missed. You know, we need a little bit of that old school hard knocks, you know, to just keep people accountable. I could have used a little bit more toughness, hard love for some of the training methods and just even for myself.
Did the tariffs affect food cost for you? And if so, how?
I think in Hawaii, we're a little behind on everything. So as much as there was a lot of laws and things that changed, it didn't quite hit us right away. There are still loopholes and things that we could work around. Of course, the cost of everything went up. Of course, getting things took longer to get. And then if you look at it, if you really think about it, yeah, the cost of goods went up, but also the cost for the vendors. So then their costs went up, which then affected us even more in that way. It's not just the food itself. It's all the people here in Hawaii that are trying to make a living, trying to stay alive in all this so expensive state that they have to raise their prices. And that's not just the food. That's the electricians and the plumbers and the maintenance guys, and all of that adds to the restaurant. I didn't charge what everybody else was charging. Almost everything we brought in was from a farm. And just that alone takes so much more time to prep, to manage, to organize, and to figure out how to use these ingredients the best way to showcase what these hardworking farmers and ranchers and producers are doing. You can look successful, but behind the scenes, are you really being successful? And I didn't really care to make money as a chef, but at the same time, is it sustainable? And it could be, but like I said, you have to have the right people.
A lot of people don't know that, you know, when you work with a food distributor, they do all of the middleman work for you. So, you know, you place an order with them and then they source all of these various ingredients from different farms, different companies, whatever, and then they, you know, aggregate it and bring it to you. But when you're working with individual farms, mom and pop farms, like a lot of chefs do here in Hawaii, you have to call every single one of them separately. And that takes a lot of time. And to build a relationship with each one of them separately, that takes a lot of time. So even if you're just doing that alone, that could take hours a week.
Yeah, it takes a lot of time. But for me, I went to every farm. I went to every person that I wanted to buy from. If I can go see the purveyor site, I'm gonna go see it. Because I wanna know who I'm working with. I'm putting my heart and soul into it. And I don't wanna waste my time on somebody that's not. I want somebody that's passionate about what they're doing, because that's gonna make their product that much better. And that's gonna make me wanna promote them and not make that extra penny so that I can, you know, give them more money for what they're growing, as opposed to trying to get a discount because I can barely make it work or I'm not motivated to do it. But if I see somebody that's really pushing hard, I don't care what I have to give, because I'm only gonna be able to do this for so long. But who in Hawaii is gonna be able to fight all of this corporate stuff? who's going to be that small business that's going to make it and be the next person that's known in Hawaii for taking care of Hawaii and making Hawaii proud. And so, like, I don't mind. I don't need a lot of money to survive. Just pay the bills.
Yeah.
You know, but other than that, like, it's cool to meet all these hardworking people. It's not cool to see their struggles, but if I can help, then that's cool, yeah. You know?
How did you know when it was time to close? What was the tipping point for you?
The tipping point was the expansion. You know, I built Namikaze, everything in it basically came from my mind with somebody else. And when we expanded, it was kind of the same thing, but there are more people involved, but there just wasn't unity. It felt like things were being done for the wrong reasons. It just didn't feel like a family. And for me, work has always been like a family because you're there all the time. We smile together, we laugh together, and we fight together, you know, and it's, things happen, and you know, sometimes we grow apart. It just didn't feel right. So right now we're at Diamond Head Market and Grill with Kelvin Rowe, and we want to do more. He's done a great job of creating this nostalgic experience when you go there. And with what we do, we want to bring in more farmers. We want to bring in more products, more techniques and different flavors to bring a different nostalgia, a new nostalgia to Diamond Head. But we got to make sure that we're working with the right people as well. And they're such a good team over there. I'm so excited to work with them. But sometimes things don't fit. So before I expand again, right now we're really rebuilding the foundation of all of the operating procedures, just the handbook itself, just to make sure everybody's on the same page and will be accountable for what we do in the future. And we're trying to keep this thing going for a while. And the cool thing about it too is there's a farm attached to it, the old Otsuji farm, and that's where I really, as soon as I can get the market stable, I want to get out there and just figure out how I can help. You know, the cooking's the cooking. I've done that forever, but I want to get earlier in the stage of cooking, and that's on the field, that's in the field, and that's with the seeds. You know, that's with the soil. So I'm excited about that. Really excited about that. I don't know if my body's gonna be able to take it, but we're gonna try. And educating through the farm is what I want to do, because everybody tries to help the farmers, and you know, there's events for it and tries to showcase what they're doing with the farmers. But how do we really make it work in Hawaii? How do we make it sustainable? Because obviously it's not working. So how can we work with the state to make it work?
What new challenges are you facing now with an increased minimum wage? How is it affecting you at Diamond Head, and how is it going to affect restaurants in general?
So this was another thought in the whole closure of Namikaze, was how does any full service restaurant survive with that high of a minimum wage for a tipped out employee? And the culture of that is just wrong. And it's always been. I'm not saying anything bad about anybody today, because ever since I entered the industry, the front of the house always made more than the back of the house. And it was a ridiculous amount that was different. And both sides are needed. Very important. Two sides connected together in unison. Very important. But in that, I'm saying they're equal. And definitely throughout the years that I've been in the industry and managing for 27 or plus years, it's never been equal. So is that right? I don't know. Is that wrong?
And it's almost like an industry standard, especially for back of the house, to just not be able to make ends meet.
It's definitely a predicament for the kitchen people in some stages and retention of staff. But at the same time, because we live in Hawaii and this is a tourist state, kitchens in the back, front of the house is in the front. They're the ones that are talking to the tourists. So it always disappoints me when I have a server that isn't the nicest person in the world and isn't attentive and isn't doing the best for the tourists that are coming here to eat and dine and spending their life savings to be in Hawaii. You know, and it's like, how much money you're getting, and you can't take care of the business for the future of Hawaii. Like the hotels, they're so expensive. Who's gonna come back here? So what does that leave for all of these businesses that are not in Waikiki? Or, you know, by the Four Seasons, everybody that somebody has to drive to, how are they gonna survive? How are they gonna sustain their business? And when the locals, they're not making enough money either to dine anymore. So it's really a scary future. And I'm so proud of people like Robin, who's just grinding at FET and getting it done. And she's in there practically every day. I'm like, when are you going on vacation? Get out of here. That's what it takes to survive. And so I know so many more that are just every day in. And what do they get for it? They get a broken home because they're not spending any time together with their significant others. So it's really scary to think of what the future holds.
Speaking of the future, I just wanted to get your opinion on what you think some of the changes are going to be in our industry this year. Do you think people will start raising their prices again?
I mean, prices are already going up, and they have been for a long time. And the smarter ones have been raising it a long time ago because they, you know, you can see the trend. But I look at the trend of the restaurants now, and I feel like I was kind of the last one to open a large-scale full-service restaurant, which might not have been the best idea. But I look at it right now, and especially with the cottage industry program and all that, like there's so many small businesses that are doing not brick and mortar. They're food trucks or they're pop-ups at farmers markets, and good God, the prices are high there. I mean, the tent doesn't cost that much, but you know, you gotta make a living. But wow, it's kind of crazy what people are charging. And if you gotta think about it, that's what it takes to make it. That's what it takes to get up, prep everything, pack it all, put it in, and that's what you have to do. You don't have any overhead, so you know, there's more labor involved, but it looks like that's where it's trending. And then right now we got all of these food courts where different restaurants are able to rent out spaces in it. Those are popping up so that there's less liability for the actual owner. It's great for Merriman's and stuff like that, where they've built their brand huge and they're doing great. And I hope they can sustain, and you know, Roy's has been here forever. But just, I don't know what's gonna happen with restaurants for small business owners.
That was HFAIR contributor Sarah Burchard talking with Chef Jason Peel, who made the decision to close his restaurant, Namekaze, at Pier 38 last year. Chef Peel has a new partnership with Diamond Head Marketing Grill to grow the Montserrat Avenue takeout eatery. The beautiful ohia tree is at the heart of a new keiki book. It's written in whimsical rhyme and colorfully illustrated by Erji Kupa Palko. Readers are invited to slow down, sit in nature, and meet Hawaii's native forest species, including manu, birds, kahuli, native snails, insects, and other plants that thrive under the ohia tree. Palko spoke with The Conversation's Lillian Song about the book. It's a result of years of studying plants, teaching performing arts and science, and hiking forest trails with her beloved pup, Ohia.
The inspiration from the book came from hiking in the forest in a rainstorm and just this bizarre sort of outburst of singing that happened spontaneously, where I just started singing that song. Under the Ohia tree, a little leaf said, breathe with me. And it kept going and kept going. And I was saying the silliest things just to make myself laugh while I was sprinting through the mud and rain to get back to the car with my dog. And when I got back, I basically just had this string of silly things. You know, under the ohia tree, a little leaf said, breathe with me. A bundle of arrow roots said, drink in the mist with me. The ropey roots said, hug the earth with me. All those things, but they're just about ohia trees, which are my favorite tree. And so I did a mock-up and I told my mom about it and showed her my little sketches. And her reaction was, that's nice, Urs, but it's really boring. It needs some animals. And then that kind of snowballed into what it is now, which is an attempt at being a pretty thorough sort of introduction to the main families of animal species that are in the forest along with the ohia trees. So she's been a guiding voice in this whole process.
Yay, Mom. I'm picturing you running through the deluge and singing to yourself. Mm. And when you pick up the book, there's these textured roots of the ohia tree. As you turn into the book, it's so vibrant. There are different animals, different creatures, different parts of the natural world. Your greatest joy is connecting with the earth. I really enjoyed how, like, you shared this note to your readers. May each visit to the forest open your heart, sight, and hearing to more and more beloved beings.
Well, thank you for noticing that. I feel very seen by it. I'm not loud about this part of it, but I will say that I pray a lot when I do any art project. And this book was no exception. It was very prayerful. I really put that intention there that anyone that came in contact with this book, that it really would inspire them to be out more with their family, making the time to visit with these precious beings. That they're really miraculous that they've held on in spite of everything that we as humans have thrown at them. Maybe the difficult part of writing this book, it's actually related to when my mom told me that this book was really boring since it didn't have any animals. So I just sort of knew that Abapane and Amakihi and Elepaio were the more known species. And I had sort of thought they were on all the islands, but I wasn't sure. So I illustrated that page and then I went to the fantastic deal on our website and was researching what birds are left. And I was pretty devastated to learn that we only had 20 species of small forest birds left on the main islands. There are a few up in the Northwest Hawaiian Islands, but on the main islands, we just had 20 left. And that in my lifetime, there were e'ivi birds on Mount Ka'ala, at least, when I was younger. But by the time I started writing the book, they hadn't been seen in 10 years up there. And it ripped my heart out to learn that. And so I thought, okay, there's only 20. I'm going to squeeze them all in here because everybody has to know about what's left here. You know, there were over 60 different small bird species on the main Hawaiian Islands, and now we're down to 20. I cried a lot, actually. So there was this urgency where I thought, okay, I love ohia trees, and if I'm going to bother people with looking at a children's book that I create, I don't want anyone else to grow up the way I did, not knowing what we had here before it was gone.
There are so many layers in this book. There's that narrative voice that, you know, you wrote down, helping us as the reader follow along. And visually, there's a bounty of characters, but there are two main characters.
I'm assuming you're referring to the dog, you know, the reddish brown dog with the white nose and white throat and white tip of her tail that's bouncing around throughout many of the pages. And that's definitely an avatar of my super puppy, you know, who's been my ride or die hiking buddy in the forest for the past 11 years. The other being is a young child. And I just wanted it to be a young kid, you know, a young Hapa kid who's mixed everything, just like all of my friends were growing up and are. I suppose it could be like maybe a representation of my inner child, you know, going around and observing things, because that's what this book is, an expression of my experience in the forest, connecting with these majestic trees and the absolute joy of getting to meet a native species that I've never met before. I don't mean it for it to be me. I mean it for that child in this book to be every child.
This is your first picture book for Keiki, but what else have you published?
I also have a coloring book of rhymes. I wanted to create one for Hawaii Island since it's so special that we have Kilauea, the active volcano here. So I worked on that, and one of my best friends, who's a elementary school teacher, she dared me to write rhymes for each one. I just rolled my eyes and I said, I'm not a writer. I'm not doing that. But then I thought, you know what? I'll just try. And it actually ended up being really fun. I was encouraged, actually, in my foray into writing rhymes by my favorite author of all time, or one of them, J.R.R. Tolkien. So when I was doing some plant science research and weighing a bunch of Olenna or turmeric that was kind of boring, or, you know, weeding in the Olenna patches, I would play The Hobbit or The Lord of the Rings and listen for hours to Tolkien being read by Andy Serkis. And what struck me was how much or how many silly rhymes are in Tolkien's writing. I mean, every single character you can think of, the hobbits, the humans, the elves, the goblins, they all sing really silly rhymes throughout the entire epic. And so I thought to myself, you know, I have no calling to write an epic tale, but he seems to be having fun writing these rhymes, so I'm going to keep trying at this. And sure enough, it's fun. If you don't like writing, I would suggest attempting to write rhymes and try to make yourself laugh doing it and see what happens. That's what I did.
Is there anything that, you know, I did not ask you that you would love to, like, share with our listeners?
I think the main thing is that there was so much that went into this book that was by the grace of other people, not only my mom giving so much feedback from the beginning. So in addition to this book being an expression of my experiences in the forest, I also did a lot of research, and I tasked myself with reading practically every, at least skimming through practically every published paper about ohia trees that I could find on Google Scholar. And then also was really specifically looking for scientific papers about insects and other native species that would be found in the forest that are common in ohia trees, so that I wasn't just putting out there my experience, but that I was gathering wisdom from the scientific community about that. And so if I found information about species I was unfamiliar with, I reached out to researchers. So many were kind enough to allow me to use some of their research photos as reference photos to sketch some of the things in here. A huge blessing, for example, was Dr. David Shisko of the Snail Extinction Prevention Lab, who allowed me to use reference photos of the kohuli, the land snails. Also Dr. Noreen Young from the Bishop Museum, who gave me critical feedback about the use of the word tree snail versus land snail and the importance of everyone knowing that there are also snails that will live in the leaf litter. From when I was young, I remember watching Hawaii Born of Fire. It's still my favorite documentary about the ecology of the Hawaiian Islands ever. But in there, there's a researcher, Dr. Rosemary Gillespie, who researches spiders. So I dared myself to even reach out to her, because her papers are it when it comes to the research about native Hawaiian spiders. So I read those papers. I got information about what sort of substrates to draw to have the spiders hiding in. And she and her husband, Dr. George Roderick, allowed me to use some of their research photos as reference photos to have some hidden spiders throughout the book too. Of course, the publisher contributed ideas for how to expand the book and to expand the information section in the end. And it was Kristen Nambarid's idea to do the texturing of the title and the roots on the front cover. An entire host of support came from the scientific community. Another really cool story is that there's a page with a nest with EEV bird chicks in it. And I knew I wanted to draw EEV bird chicks, but I couldn't find any photographs of them. So I couldn't ask anyone for a reference photo because I wasn't seeing any anywhere in books or online. So originally, for a long time, that nest was just empty. And I decided, well, I can just make the EEV birds building a nest since I can't find a picture of what these chicks look like. But after a while of looking at it, it was so disappointing to have a nest there and not have chicks in it. So I found a description of what EEV bird chicks look like in a book called Hawaiian Bird Life by Andrew Berger, and painted up a version. And I thought, okay, well, this looks like what he's describing. And so put it out there, and the book got vetted by the Brett Nainoa Mossman, who's very active with ornithology in the state. And He looked at it and told the publisher, no, that's not what Evie Bird Chicks looks like. She needs to make this darker and color this beak differently and do this and that. So I got notes from Brett about how to redo the Evie Bird Chicks so that they look legitimate. And I finished the draft that's in there now, and they showed it to him and he gave it the thumbs up. So thanks to Brett and Ainoa Mossman, there's a visual representation of Evie Bird Chicks that people can see now. That's another way that the science community has contributed to this book. So it's definitely been a team effort. And I'm really forever grateful to everybody who contributed so generously to the creation of this book.
And that was writer and illustrator Erji Kuba Palko and HBR's Lillian Song. Palko's cakey book, Under the Ohia Tree, is available at local bookstores and online. You can meet her this Sunday. There's a book reading and signing at the Ohia Love Fest in Hilo. Look for an online event also on February 17th for the Awai Hui Hia Kumu Network and Malama Learning Center. And that's it for this Aloha Friday. Coming up next week, we plan to hear from the governor in his State of the State address and talk more about legislative priorities. Call our talkback line. Tell us what you think. 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Our program is produced by Maddie Bender, Lillian Song, and Kevin Allen with support from Savannah Harriman-Pote and the HPR digital team. The Backyard Quiz theme written for us by John DeMello. Our theme music courtesy of Gypsy 808. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday. Pick up the conversation.